This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato at the Mondavi Center in Davis, California. Our next story has all the markings of a sci-fi thriller. We have high-tech planes swooping over a forest of giant wizened old trees, shooting lasers through the forest canopy. We have an army of exponentially multiplying unstoppable invaders, and of course our heroes, a band of scientists striving to save life from destruction. Except this really is not science fiction. It is a battle that is happening right here in California, and my next guests are two of the protagonists. You might think of them as Luke and Leia, so to speak, trying to save the forest from destruction. Greg Asner is an ecologist at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford, California. Christina Restano is a research scientist at UC Davis, and she works with the California Fire Science Consortium. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Greg, you got to have one of the coolest jobs in the world, flying over these amazing places like Yosemite in a small plane.
Yeah, it's a good time. We try to work, but we have a good time doing it. What you see on the screen is a picture of my latest creation, which is the Carnegie Airborne Observatory 3. So we're in our third version. It looks like a simple aircraft, but on board there's some unique technology that allows us to measure the health and condition of forests. We have very high power computers, and we have sensors that can read the condition of the forest.
So how do you read that condition? What are you doing to monitor? What kind of instrumentation do you have?
We do something unique called laser-guided spectroscopy, and what that's about is sending out signals of laser beams and reading those signals back, creating a 3D surface of the vegetation, and at the same time, critically looking at the chemical composition of that canopy. And today we measure up to 20 different chemical traits of these trees as we fly over, and we use those traits to diagnose, just like going to the doctor and getting a blood test, diagnose the health of every tree that we fly over.
And do you do this once a year or twice a year or different seasons?
Here in California, we're doing it once a year. We're doing an annual assessment, do an update on the state of the forests of California, and we do this all over the planet.
Wow. And Christina, while Greg surveys from the sky, I understand you like to be with your feet on the ground.
Absolutely.
What are you doing?
I like my
here?
Feet to be on the ground as much as absolutely possible. What I do more is I walk around outside in the woods and I try to evaluate and survey the health of the forest, and then also try to look and see if any of the areas that have been thinned or burned to reduce the overall stand crowding and the density in the forest to see if that makes any difference. Unfortunately, what is happening is that these trees are overwhelmed by the combination of the water stress and the beetle outbreak. We have this overcrowding of the forest. There are too many straws in the cup, right? So we just have too many trees in a certain area, and then you combine that with warmer winters where the bark beetles are able to reproduce all winter long. In the past, the beetles would actually sleep in the wintertime and not reproduce because it was too cold. But as it gets warmer, now we have so many more beetles and we have so many trees in the forest. You combine those two things together and we have the current issue that we're facing.
Greg, as you're looking down, are you seeing the same kind of damage like this?
Oh,
from
yeah.
Different plane?
The rate of change in the last 5 years is amazing. What started out, here's a shot just from our cockpit, kind of hard to see on the screen, but that's a vast area, kind of central Sierras, mostly sugar pine in that area that have succumbed. And most of that happened in the last 12 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of the drought we're having out
yeah.
here?
Yeah, drought and the beetle combined. Yeah.
Hmm. And so you really, what you have is a double whammy that you're saying.
You absolutely do. So the trees themselves are not producing enough sap. So this is a key part of the whole story. So in order for trees to grow, they have to have water. It's a key part of the whole entire
That makes
key
sense.
Part. Exactly.
Yeah,
and
more.
So trees will first invest in their roots in order to get more water. They will then invest in their leaves so that they produce more of the factories that help them grow. They will then try to get taller and then to reach more light. Then they will try to get wider and then after that, they can invest in SAP. So they have to cover their costs first, then they can invest in SAP. Why is that important? SAP is important to push the beetles out. If the beetles are attracted to the stressed trees and they don't have enough SAP, it gets pushed out. So I have seen some folks talking about, oh, I have had to cut so many trees in my yard. And, you know, everyone says, well, you can't use those for firewood. They've got too much pitch or SAP. But not in this case. All the trees are bone dry. There is no SAP.
Mm-hmm. If you have questions in the audience, we have our microphones out there. Please feel free to get up to them. And Greg, you make 3D models of these forests, right?
That's right.
What do they look like?
They're 3D models, but they're 3D chemical models. So what we're able to do is see inside the tree canopy, the foliage of the tree, and tell you how much water is in the tree, how much sugar and starch, we call that carbohydrates, and how much nitrogen is in the tree, and a lot of other chemicals. So my point of looking at this way is that we see the future. We see into the future in terms of which trees are really on their way out before we can actually count them as dead. And that number is massive in this state right now.
Let's see if we have a question out here. Yes.
Is there a way to, like, save a mass majority of the trees?
Can you save them? Yeah. What can you do to save them? And they're competing for each other with water, right? That you're saying that's, can we stop them competing somehow?
Well, I think that the trees that are already impacted, unfortunately, we can't do anything to save those trees, and you would agree with that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But I would certainly say that we have an opportunity to manage our forests by reducing the crowding and the density and also promoting the use of wildfire and prescribed fire in forests. It's really in these ecosystems in the Sierra Nevada, fire is a natural part of the ecosystems here, and it has been excluded for so long that is why we have so many trees, because it used to be that the fire would come through and thin out the forest. It would kill some of the trees. We don't have that anymore, so now we have this problem. So we really do have an opportunity to thin and to use fire in a constructive way. And I'll let you add, Greg.
Yeah, well, our imaging is allowing fire management to think about where to put fire so that we can thin the forest and also do it in a way that's accommodating to the extremely dry conditions that we have. Probably don't want to put fire in some of the driest parts of the forest from the get-go. You probably want to do it in some of the areas that are crowded, just like we're talking about, but that aren't so wicked dry. And there is a lot of variation out there to manage.
I almost thought I heard you say that the beetles know how to find the sick trees. They have a beetle radar somehow?
This is actually really cool. So, well, I think because I'm a nerdy scientist, but trees, when the roots sense that it's very dry, they actually send a chemical signal to the tree to release a gas into the bole of the tree. By doing this, it reduces the overall content of water in the tree and tricks the tree to pull more water from the roots. That gas is a pheromone that attracts the bark beetles. So it's that was actually one of the things that I learned as a student that made me say, I want to be an ecologist, because that's really interesting.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's self-destructive.
It is, but it used to be that worked out okay, because some of the trees would get stressed, some would then die by the beetles, and that was okay, because these beetles are a natural part of the ecosystem at endemic levels. But what we have now is it's an epidemic level because the warmer winters, the overcrowded forests, the very stressed trees.
Okay, let's take a question from over here on this side. Yes, sir.
Hi, I was wondering, have you been able to apply any of the new knowledge about the newly discovered wood wide web to helping trees?
The wood wide web.
So I think you are referring to Suzanne Simard's work, and where trees can actually communicate underground with their roots through the mycorrhizal. Which is networks of mushrooms that are growing underground and helping trees access nutrients, which is really fascinating in and of itself. But I think that I'm not sure how we can utilize that in the management sense in order to better, that's really just a way that trees can access each other and the nutrients, but I'm not quite sure how we can tap into that tree communication strategy in order to help them through this issue.
Greg, do you have anything
to
add?
I mean, it's pretty hard to get water into the system if it's not coming in. I mean,
absolutely.
No matter how many tricks nature has invented, this new or changing climate system that we're in now, this regime, the last 10 years out of the last 14 have been drier than the long-term norm, and the last three have been the driest 3 years since 1895. So depending on how you look at it, is it long-term? The climate scientists are telling us this could be a long-term dry period for California that we're in now. We don't know. So as ecologists, I think we're trying to study the drought from the trees' perspective at different scales and then figure out management possibilities.
Can you tell from the snowpack of the year before whether there's going to be a drought in the trees or not?
Nowadays, we're not looking at snowpack to understand how the trees are doing and what they will do. We're looking at the tree chemistry to predict where they're going next.
And how good is that prediction?
I predicted the Forest Service showed 66 million this year, and I predicted about 60 million. So I'm plus or minus 10%.
That will
10%.
Die?
60, yeah.
60 million trees will die.
We already have
that's
66
already.
Million dead
that's
trees
dead.
In this year.
So my prediction was accurate. Yeah. And that's based on tree chemistry before the death phase.
So he is able to show these trees will produce less sap.
Yeah.
That's essentially what he's able to show.
That's right.
With the complicated chemistry.
About a year in advance now.
Yeah.
We're getting towards about a year in advance.
That's amazing. Let's go to this questioner. Yes.
I have a question. I wonder if you guys know, it seems like CO2 emissions that, you know, is being caused by man is the major cause of the acidification that we see in the water and then also now the destruction of all these trees. And I'm wondering, do you guys know what it would take to in order to bring down those CO2 levels such that we could maybe reverse the climate changes that we're currently causing?
I'll let you take this one.
Sure.
Go ahead. Hot one.
You asked the grand question. It's a matter of sequestering as much carbon dioxide as we can out of the atmosphere today. One of the cheapest, best, most efficient ways to do that is in forests. They store a lot of carbon. And thank you. And one of the other ways that but the main thing we got to do is start to decrease our emissions now. We can't be waiting and kind of dragging our feet. That's got to be something we do right now.
There you go. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Greg Asner and Christina Restano. Growing trees suck up a lot of CO2. Is it a folly to try to plant new young trees where the old ones are dying? Because they're going to, you know, be growing. Or are they not going to be growing? Or is this sort of just wasting your time doing that?
Well, I think that it's important to replant, but it's important to not plant in dense spacing. So that is something that happens a lot. Immediately, you know, we'll have these huge, big, gigantic wildfires. We'll have all of these trees die, and then folks will go back in and plant at very narrow spacing. And that is just, we are really trying to urge away from that because we have learned now that if the trees are too dense, if you plant too close together and dense, we're just going to have the same problem. So you have to be really aware of how much you are planting. And it's important to think about the fact that yes, trees are an important part of this process to sequester CO2, but we want to be sure to not plant so dense that they'll all just die again or burn in a wildfire. So you really have to balance that issue.
I would just like to add that Californians might need to think about the idea that we're going to be in a drier future, and that might change the species of trees that we have. So the density is critical, exactly about all those issues are totally right, but in addition, maybe the actual composition of our forests will change, and that means the type of trees that get planted.
So are the pines we're seeing, are they the ones that are most in danger?
Yeah, well, lately it's been sugar pines and ponderosa pine. Yeah.
And so what might we see taking over as they go?
Species that are more drought tolerant.
Like what?
There are chaparral species in California. There are oaks. There are different types of species that can handle the drier conditions. I don't know, maybe you know, whether some of those species can survive at higher altitude as well in colder conditions. Mm-hmm. And if not any of the ones we have in California, it might be others.
Yeah. All right, let's go which side? Let's go this side, yes.
Hello. If you could make the best of a bad situation and turn the trees that are dying, like the 66 million trees that are pretty much dead, could you turn those into paper and like save some energy?
Yeah, so the species that are dying here are not commonly used for that type of a material, but they could be used for wood and lumber. One big problem that we have in California is our sawmills have closed. So there isn't anywhere to send the timber. So that has become a real problem because we have more wood than we know how to handle. So we moved from overlogging our forest years and years ago to now underlogging them and not having the capacity to deal with that wood.
Mm-hmm. Let me get one more question over here. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, as a follow-up to that, how do we create a demand for all this pine as a lumber product? And then how do we get incentives to burn some of it as waste for biomass to make electricity?
I like pointing at each other, too.
Well, that is a really good question and something that we're kind of struggling with as a in this new world where we don't have the sawmills and where we have all of these trees that are dying. We are really struggling to figure out, honestly, how to use it. So I can't really answer that because I don't know.
Well, we'll answer that next time we're back here. Yeah. At UC Davis, because we've run out of time, I want to thank my guest, Greg Asner, ecologist at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Stanford, California, Christina Restano, research scientist at the University of California, Davis, who works with the California Fire Science Consortium. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Up next, we've talked about water. An animal that has adapted to living in a world without water. But first, once again, let's turn it over to Joe Kai and Brian Chris Rogers. This is Science Friday from PRI.